You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
E-commerce business owners know the best way to run a successful business is to keep their customers happy. You build trust with your customers one package at a time. That's why smart retailers use ShipStation. ShipStation helps you run the smoothest order fulfillment process possible and cut costs, not corners. ShipStation streamlines all your orders from everywhere you sell into one easy-to-use dashboard, prints shipping labels, manages returns, and tracks inventory. You can even automate repetitive tasks so your team makes fewer errors. Plus, they get you the lowest possible carrier rates. You'll save up to 88% off UPS, USPS, and DHL Express, and up to 90% off FedEx rates. When shoppers choose to buy your products, turn them into loyal customers with cheaper, faster, and better shipping. Go to ShipStation.com/program to sign up for your free trial. There's no credit card or contract required, and you can cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com/program.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. It's a very warm welcome back as Dr. David Clark returns to the show. With the continual revelations about the Calvine photos and the weirdness that weaves through it, David explains the leads he's followed, the evidence he's uncovered, the witnesses he's now spoken to, and what may come next. We will also dive into the folklore revival as David and his colleagues at the Centre for Contemporary Legend prepare to launch the first national folklore survey in the UK for over 60 years. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to each and every one of you that support the show with your contributions. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and links. You can also visit our exclusive merchandise store via TeePublic, and the links for both are in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Stall of the Ghost Story Guys. Ufology and folklore combine next with the marvellous Dr. David Clark. The relentless march of modernisation throughout the 20th century looked to push folklore out to the margins, but yet the 21st century has seen a new generation embrace our global histories, and the essence of folklore seemingly seems to be growing back year upon year. And with this in mind, I am delighted to extend an overdue welcome back to the wonderful Dr. David Clark. David, how are we?
Fine, thank you. Great to be back on, Paul, and I'm amazed. It's, what was it, 4 or 5 years since I was last graced these airways?
Absolutely. Well, you've been a busy man. You've kept yourself digging into things, as I would expect from a man of your reputation, sir. You've been, not like you've been sat at home twiddling your thumbs.
No, I wish I had some time. Yeah, no time to twiddle thumbs. There's just more and more things to cope with all the time. But it's great.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I suppose, I mean, in essence, we've a lot to kind of cover in regards to the work that you're undertaking through the Centre of Contemporary Legend in regards to the, the rise of folklore, as I mentioned in the introduction. But I think, obviously, since we last spoke, there's been quite a lot happened to one of Britain's most notorious UFO incidents that seemed to be, as I remember you describing it at the time in the press, like a John le Carré novel in regards to the twists and turns and machinations that seem to be going on. And this is, of course, the infamous Calvine photo that seemed to be unsolvable, David. And yet, here we are, 4 years on from your incredible groundwork, along with your colleagues in tracking this down. And we seem to have another mystery now on top of, now we've got the photo, we need to know what's gone on after that.
Yeah, we do. I mean, the last big development was The Guardian did a really big feature. Danny Lavelle from Manchester, who's actually writing a book on UFOs, which I think is out later this year. So he actually knows something about the background to the subject, which a lot of journalists don't. Mm. They're just coming to it, you know, cold. So it was great that they took interest in, and they actually devoted most of their G2, you know, the long form journalism thing that they have in The Guardian to this. And I think that the interest came from James Fox's documentary program, because he had a big long section in there where he came to Sheffield. He saw the, we showed him the image that's now in our archive. He went up to Scotland. He's the only one that's actually been on site and interviewed Craig Lindsay. Did a really good job, although I completely disagree with James's interpretation of what is going on. You know, he's definitely a dyed-in-the-wool ET believer and government cover person, and I respect that. I can see where he's arrived, how he's reached that position. But what I liked about him was he, you know, he was willing to sort of come over here and actually talk to us rather than just, you know, sitting on the other side of the Atlantic and sort of making out he knows what was going on. You know, he really put some shoe leather in, went up to Scotland, got a drone in the sky, and I really respect him for that, because no one else. I am absolutely amazed that up to now the BBC have completely ignored this story. You know, even BBC Scotland have not run anything on this story, despite this photo, as you know, being in the Daily Mail, being all over the news, being subject to all these documentaries. I just find that utterly baffling. It's not a cover-up. It's just for whatever reason, they've chosen not to mention it, which is a shame, because I think the thing we want to do is find the photographers. And I think regardless of what people think about the BBC now, it does have a big sort of local following in its various regions. And I just think getting something on BBC Scotland would be a good way of actually helping us find someone who knows more about the circumstances.
Absolutely. I mean, it was quite interesting, because I spoke to an old friend of yours, Malcolm Robinson, the other week in regards to his overview of the Bonnybridge incident. And obviously, as you were saying about the BBC's lack of interest in this particular story, the amount of times the BBC Scotland were doing like a live report from Bonnybridge in the mid to late 90s, David, is remarkable when you look at, especially in this day and age, where they seem to have re-embraced paranormal television with the success of Uncanny with Danny Robbins, and obviously the other series that they've done on BBC Three, looking into a few paranormal cases. It's almost as if they've kind of gone back to that, which they hadn't touched for the best part of 20 years. But ufology is still, to the BBC, a subject that nobody seems to be comfortable covering properly.
Yeah. Well, they see it as entertainment. That's the problem. And the whole Danny Robbins phenomenon is it's a stage act. I mean, it purports to be an investigation with this Team Skeptic and Team Believer thing, which I absolutely hate. But it sort of means that whenever anything else comes along like this, whoever makes the decision from the BBC say, oh, we don't want to do anything about this because Danny Robbins has done it. That's something we can just leave to Danny Robbins. But Danny Robbins isn't covering this subject in the depth that it deserves. But, you know, this is up to the BBC. And what I liked about the Guardian article was the Guardian doesn't really cover this kind of subject, and they took it seriously. It was treated seriously. And the interesting thing is it was the most read article on the Guardian website that day. You know, there was literally millions of people reading it. It was up there, number one, above all the royal stories on that particular day. And they then ran a series of letters in the follow-up, I think about a week later, from people saying, great that The Guardian's covering this. Let's see more of this, please. It shows that the serious media are treating this subject as a matter of serious attention rather than something to make jokes about, you know, with the Green Men and all the rest of it. And again, Michael Bollander from Durham Law School, who's another academic that's working involved in this subject now, he got a really good letter on there. And on the back of that, he's created this thing called the Durham Declaration on UAP, which I recommend go and have a look at and sign up to that, because he's made a series of statements online basically saying to government, this is the House of Lords thing that he's involved in, you know, this subject needs proper attention, needs to be taken seriously.
Ah, absolutely. Yeah. I shall certainly check that out. As always, you give me homework, David.
So, I mean, in terms of where we are with the Calvin case, I'm going to have to be careful here, because there's things afoot that are going to happen later this year, which I can't go into now. But, yeah, I mean, it's the 35th anniversary of the photograph in August. It was August 1990, and we're still on we're still trying to track down the photographers, and this is the most bizarre aspect of it. And I think this is what was in the Guardian article that Danny Lavelle picked up on, and the fact that how can the photographers have disappeared so comprehensively as they appear to have done? Mm. And my view is that they haven't disappeared; that they are around. It's just that for whatever reason, they don't want to talk, which I find baffling, given the fact that their photograph, when they own the copyright to the photograph, is all over the world. So if it was a hoax, as it may, it's not impossible it was, why say nothing? And why is it that no one, I don't know, everyone has relatives, don't they? Friends, ex-girlfriends, people who work with them, et cetera, et cetera. Why has no one come forward except one person, Richard Grieve, who's the guy from the ex-chef who worked in Fisher's Hotel in Pitlochry, who said he worked with these two guys, you know, and he was there. And I know a lot of people regard what he said as a fairy tale, but the fact remains that he contacted me by email saying that he knew these two lads, he was there, and he did that with information that he could not have had before I published the article in the Mail in 2022. Mm. That, to me, is significant.
I mean, this is the thing. I remember I got in a spat with somebody about 18 months ago talking about the sort of origin of the Calvin photo, and precisely about the fact that the guys were on about, they were outside in the car park having a cigarette. And this guy was, well, there isn't a car park there. And I thought, okay, well, that's very easy to check. So I checked it and there is. And I said, well, what's this? Oh, well, that's not a proper car park. Well, it's a car park, isn't it? Oh, well, that's not what they meant. How do you know? You don't know them. What are you talking about? So now you've got people claiming that car parks don't exist in regards to this, because they're so adamant that the story isn't true. And you've seen so many people put forward their theories, such as the rock in the river. It's a hoax. It's a Christmas ornament. It's all this kind of thing. And I think it baffles me that they've essentially ignored the bits of supporting evidence in regards to the work you guys have done in regards to analysing the photo, looking at the authenticity of it, finding the guy that had the only surviving original photograph of this. And the fact that it kind of does tie back to these kind of UFO fables that we had for the best part of 25 years, where, like I said earlier on, Nick Pope would talk about this photo that claimed to be the best ever, and nobody even thought it was real. It was just a figment of imagination. Was it just one of those typical tall tales you get in the UFO world, where it becomes one of those stories that everybody keeps going back to, when really, when you look at it, there's no real sort of real meat on the bones of the actual story. It's a story of a story of a story that, as often happens with some of these stories, they just adapt and change and they become version of the original story. And yet we now have to look and say, well, he was talking about this and he was right. So he must have had some kind of insight into the original incident. We just didn't have anything happen for the following 25 years until it sort of burst out during the pandemic.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this story is, this is what people struggle with, is in most cases, and this is like the Danny Robbins approach, you've got the people who were directly experienced it telling the story. Whereas here, we don't have that. We have a photograph, don't we? So it's almost inverted, and we don't have the people who took that photograph. All we have is a second-hand account of what they said to Craig Lindsay, the RAF press officer, on the phone. And that people just can't get their head around the complexity of this case. And bear in mind, we don't, although it's all the attention being focused on this print, the last surviving original print that was made of this thing, there are somewhere 5 other images, colour images. And the reason that this one isn't colour is that it's been run through one of the big machines that they used to have in newspaper offices in the late 1990s. And I know this because I worked on the Sheffield Star. So I operated one of these things. So if you can imagine, maybe someone was in a newspaper and they'd been photographed, maybe holding a cheque or something.
Yes.
They'd appeared in their local paper. So you'd say, oh, Auntie so-and-so wants to print of that. And you go to your local newspaper office and you say, oh, this photo. And someone would say, yeah, we can run you off, one off. And so they'd go up to the photography department and they'd have the original negative or whatever it was. And they'd just run it through this huge machine. And you get a big sort of, I don't know what the dimensions would be, the dimensions of the Kelvin print that we've got. And you'd take it home and you'd frame it and et cetera, et cetera. So that's why it's not colour, because it's from a colour negative, but it's been put through a machine that produces black and white prints. So it's still an original print from the original negatives. Mm. Now, what happened to those original negatives is the big mystery, because the Ministry of Defence say they sent them back to either the Daily Record, and the Daily Record, as you know, the picture editor who was central to all of this, the guy who actually rang Craig Lindsay to say that these two guys had brought these images in, he's dead. Andy Allen, he died in 2007. So we can't ask him what went on. And the editor at the time, Endel Laird, he died in 2011 or 2012. So he's another key person at the newspaper. No one else at the newspaper can tell us why they didn't run the story, which, again, I just find as a journalist baffling, because you would run a story regardless of the reality status of the images. Mm. A story of this type. I was a journalist on the Sheffield Star at the same time the Daily Record got these images. If somebody had brought those images in, it would have been right next day, front page. Doesn't matter what the RAF say, whether they say it's a fake or not. Mm. The pictures are amazing. You get them on your front page straight away.
Yeah.
You know. So I find it baffling. That is the thing that really gets me.
Mm. I think the thing that strikes me most about this, like you say, it would have been very easy for these two lads, especially at the period that the photo was taken and everything that happens in the decade afterwards. I mean, the 1990s, it was UFO central all over the world. It was popular culture. It was one of the biggest shows in the world was focused on it. You had conferences all over the place. We had the UFO conference in Sheffield in the mid-90s. Yeah. Even had John Keel as guest of honour come over. Our friend Philip Mantle. So
in Scotland, you've mentioned the Bonnie Bridge Triangle. I mean, that was huge. I mean, and that, don't forget, that was about 1995. So it was well after this story.
Mm.
And the amazing thing is Malcolm Robinson doesn't know anything about it, does he? And he was Mr. Scotland. It managed to pass him by.
Yeah.
And the same picture editor, Andy Allen, who dealt with this, was actually talking to Malcolm regularly, because in the MOD files, there's other stories that were sent to the Daily Record that Andy Allen sent to Malcolm Robinson for comment.
Mm.
So get your head around that. So why did he never mention these photos?
It is. Because obviously when I spoke to Malcolm recently, we were starting about the genesis of Bonnie Bridge, and obviously there were sightings in the 80s, and then it all kind of kicked off late 92. But in the book that he's co-written with Ron Halliday, they're talking about these press reports that start at the end of 92. So the Scottish press were interested in UFOs 2 years after Kelvin. And obviously massively, the Daily Record at the time was, I'm not sure if it still is, but it was the biggest selling daily in Scotland, because obviously it's the sister paper of the Daily Mirror that we've got in England and Wales. So the Record had a massive reach. It was Scotland's number one newspaper. They did cover other weird things. I mean, they always covered stories about Nessie. They'd always cover stories about haunted locations in Scotland. They covered Bonnie Bridge all the way through the decade. Kelvin, they didn't even go back to it. You would, like you say there, if you've got the editor liaising with one of Scotland's most notable ufologists throughout that period, at what point do you think about mentioning Kelvin? Surely you would say, well, what do you think about that? Which then suggests what went on and this original thing, because you've got this RAF are saying one thing, Daily Record are saying another. We've never heard from the witnesses. We don't know why that story didn't run and where the other evidence has gone. It's so perplexing.
It is. And this is what interests me. And I mean, during the course of the last 5 years, I've had contacts with all kinds of people from, what shall we say, ex-MOD, contacted me about this and said, you know, keep pushing. You know, it was a genuine photograph. There's no two ways about it, and you know, something's gone on there, you know, and you need to get to the bottom of it. And in fact, he was talking to one of these people, someone who worked closely with Nick Pope, who also had the photo as a big poster on his wall, who basically mentioned this to me and reignited my interest in it after I'd spoken to Nick Pope about it back in 2001,
yeah,
when I interviewed him in London, and he was talking about it then. And then when that really crap, grainy photocopy emerged in the Ministry of Defence papers, you know, at the National Archives. Again, that then, that was the first time that the image had appeared outside of Nick Pope's original mention of it. And again, at that time, because I was running that project, I did my best to follow it up. I spoke to journalists in Scotland. I spoke to the then person on News Desk in Scotland who claimed, we've heard about this, but no one here remembers it. Baffling. Couldn't get any further with it, and I had loads of other things to deal with from the files, as you know, so I just let it run. And it wasn't until I think it was 2018 that I actually came across the name of this chap who worked on UFOs in British intelligence. I won't go into how I got his name, but he was more than happy to talk to me. But I didn't when I contacted him, it was just to ask about the subject and his involvement in it. And we just talked for quite some time about the general daily duties of the job. And, Nick Pope, he's had all the attention. But it was me who did the work. I had the resources. If I needed to go and investigate something, I'd just, you know, hop on a plane or something.
And
so it was like, well, what sticks in your mind from that time that you were covering this? And it was, that time in Scotland with the two lads who were out poaching on the moors, and they posing with their kill, and this thing appeared in the background and snap, 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 snap. And as he's saying this, I'm thinking, it's a camping incident, isn't it? And even he was saying, it caused a huge fuss with the Americans. And I said, well, why did the Daily Record not run it? And he could not give me an answer. But various other people, another guy, RAF guy, who I've spoken to since, and I don't know whether this is made up or it's his favourite theory. His theory is the reason why we haven't found the photographers is not because they've been served with a D-notice or something. It's that they were Russians, agents, basically, and they were, if you wanted to disappear, if you wanted to be anonymous, and you were in a foreign country, how would you do it? Where would you go and undercover? You'd be a part-time chef in a hotel in the Scottish Islands, wouldn't you? Or you work in one of these places where you take your car and they give you a jet wash. You know, that's how you'd hide, and you'd under an assumed name. So his idea was, this is the John le Carré aspect of this. They knew something was flying around that was top secret. This is, don't forget, this is as the just days after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. They knew it was being tested. They knew it was being flown. So they were in Scotland. They took the photographs. What's a good way then of blowing the cover of this machine that was based at Machrihanish? Take it to the local newspaper, the story, which is what they did, as we know. The interesting thing then is, why did they not run the story? Is it because, you know, someone cottoned on to what was going on here and tapped someone on the shoulder and said, don't run those photos, you know, there's a war on. There's no such thing as a D-notice. It's not like a bit of paper that's served on a journalist. And in this case, Kendall Laird, the editor of the Daily Record, was a press representative on the D-notice committee. So the D-notice committee is a group of journalists from TV, broadcast, et cetera, who meet with people from the MOD on a regular basis. There is one now. So during a war, it's like, here are things that we don't want people to talk about. And they would say, right, those photographs that you've had submitted, please don't run them because it's an experimental aircraft and we don't want the Russians seeing what we're testing. So this is the theory about what went on. May or may not be true. It may well be a rock sticking out of the pond, as some people prefer to believe. Yeah, but to me, as a journalist, I know what appeals to me more, and I think the circumstantial evidence supports that something went on, maybe not as elaborate as I've suggested there, but that isn't my theory. That's someone ex-RAF who came out with that one.
Mm. I mean, it was a strange period that as well, because I remember it quite well, primarily because I was at college, and I remember being absolutely baffled as to why the media had to not play certain songs, that certain bands had to change their names because they were all war-related. The two key ones I remember, a Massive Attack, were not allowed to be called Massive Attack. They had to change their name to Massive for about 6 months. Bomb the Bass had to change that. He became Tim Simonon on his own until the Gawait conflict was over. I think a band called Little Angels, who were a rock band, they had a single out at the time called Spitfire, which just bombed because it wasn't getting any airplay, ironically. And so when you're 19, David, and you've grown up in Great Britain, you really, I was very surprised by this kind of suppression and tailoring of terms that could be used, because I was thinking, ironically, I was thinking, well, you know, we don't live in Russia. I'm sure people aren't going to get frightened because they hear a song by Massive Attack on the radio. And it just shows you, we're talking about 35 years ago. And yes, the fall of the Soviet Union, as it was then, was in full swing as well. So you'd got all that kind of mini conflicts bursting out all over Eastern Europe. So it was a very hectic time, but it seemed to be like 6 months and then everything went back to normal in regards to media and popular culture. So is the Calvine incident wrapped up in all that kind of stuff that went on, that I would imagine not a lot of people would remember it particularly, because it was a very odd period.
Yeah, and also people were more, they deferred to authority more in those days. And if you can imagine, if these weren't Russian agents, if they were just two ordinary lads, as Richard Grieve remembers them, you're talking 18, 19, 20-year-olds in precarious employment, working, washing up dishes in a hotel kitchen. And don't forget, in Pitlochry, even today, it's the place where a lot of the people working in the hotels are temporary staff. They just go there, they work in the summer, they move on to somewhere else. Mm. So the fact they've disappeared, they've probably just gone back to their homes in wherever it is. But if this happened in the way that it was described, and these two guys turned up from the Ministry of Defence and said, right, we don't want you talking about this. You can imagine two 18 and 19-year-olds being questioned by two guys in a car that's come up from London or wherever, or Edinburgh, you know, with official-looking passes, and, you know, you've seen something that you shouldn't have seen. This is, you know, there's a war going on in the Middle East, and you were up to no good, you know. They were. It's true that they were out poking. You can see the way the conversation would have gone. Right, well, we won't tell the police about what you were doing. You just put your signature on this bit of paper here, which is like official secret site, which, again, has no standing with civilians. As civilians, they should not have been coerced into signing anything. But, you know, maybe they were so scared about this, maybe money was exchanged, you know, and so even 30 years on, they're thinking, what's in it for me? To come out and tell my story. Mm. You know, I made this agreement at the time. I don't want this dredging up. I've got a new family now. I'm whatever. I don't want to get into a load of trouble. I don't want TV camera crews drawing up outside my house and a whole bunch of UFO fanatics turning up asking me to tell the story. So you can see why someone in that position might just think, I'm saying nothing. I'm keeping stum. What's in it for me?
Yeah. I mean, even the fact that nobody's come forward and said, yeah, it's a hoax, doesn't make sense, because that would be the easiest way to put it to bed, would it not?
I think so, yeah.
It makes no sense.
It may well be a hoax. I mean, another scenario is that it was a prank of some kind. I mean, a very sophisticated one, but then there have been lots of sophisticated UFO pranks. Maybe they were just, oh, let's create a UFO photograph. They took it to the newspapers thinking that they were going to make some money out of it. Little did they know, within a couple of days, it's at the MOD. The MOD are then sending people up to Scotland to interview them. They'll be thinking, oh, my God, what have we triggered off here? Oh, we want this to go away. Don't want the record to run it. It's all these things. But either way, it's a cracking story from the point of view of its value as a story.
Yeah. Well, that's the other aspect as well. If the RAF came up and put the kibosh on them, surely it would be better for them to say, oh, well, it's just a hoax. We were just having a laugh.
Yeah.
And that would be it. Instead, what you've got are all these additional bits after that point of the MOD and the UFO desk treating it with great reverence, and everybody saying it's the greatest picture ever taken.
Well, it's difficult on this because the these so-called technical experts at the Ministry of Defence have been fooled before. And if you think about the Condyne report, in the frontispiece of that is the hoax photograph from Belgium, you know, the triangle that was a styrofoam. And they've got it down as a genuine UFO photograph. So the idea that, oh, like, the Ministry of Defence can possibly be fooled by a photograph. We can go, how far do you want to go back with this? Alex Birch, 1962, a young lad with a tiny camera. I don't think the Air Ministry were fooled for a minute, but they couldn't also say that he was lying. Hmm. So, you know, there's a long history here.
Yeah.
It's not sort of like cameras take pictures of things that are actually there. There's a whole story behind this. But what I would say about Calvin is that every single one of the people I've spoken to in the military, well, not every single one, there's one referral, have said, this is a genuine photograph, it's not a hoax. So that was the first thing I said to this guy, this intelligence officer who came out with this, unbidden, without me asking about it. I said, well, it's a hoax, isn't it? And it was like, definitely not a hoax. You know, this caused an enormous meltdown with the Americans because they could not believe that their top secret reconnaissance platform had been captured by two guys out on the moors in a series of photographs. So, and Nick Pope has said the same thing. He said, you know, from what he remembers, don't forget he wasn't the desk officer at the time. He arrived afterwards. It was Owen Hartop who dealt with the case. It was him who put the photo on the wall that Nick Pope then saw when he arrived to take over the UFO desk position. But that's beside the point. And also the print that we've got, the analysis that Andrew Robinson's been able to do here at Alum University. I mean, he's looked at all of the classic photos, you know, the Alex Birch one, the Stephen Pratt one from Conisbrough. They're all, you can immediately see, using modern analysis techniques of which I know nothing, but Andrew knows a lot, how they've been produced, painted on glass, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the three big ideas that have been put forward for the Calvin incident, this idea of it being a rock sticking out of a lock, for instance, it being a dangling model from the tree, and the thing about it being a temperature inversion with the mountain sticking out, not a single one of them stand up to even remote scrutiny, looking at original print. They've all got, it's basically Occam's razor in reverse, in that to actually apply, there's so many things that have got to happen that don't fit in with what we know the circumstances were. And the one that's most likely, I think, is the thing about it being a model dangling from a tree. But even if it was, you've got, let's say they've got the diamond thing, the Christmas ornament dangling from the tree. You've also then got to have someone with a fishing rod, which is what I've tried to recreate, with the Harrier jet going around it like that, you know. And apparently on one of the other prints that we haven't seen, there's two Harrier jets circling around it. So you've got a dangling object, you've got two guys with fishing rods, or maybe they waited for the two Harrier jets because they knew it was an area where low-level jet practice happens, and it is. Maybe they set it up so that these two jets came in and then they put the dangling object in. But, I mean, the level of planning, and isn't it just easier to believe that they were where they said they were, and they saw this silent object with the two jets circling around it? Mm-hmm. That has got the fewest assumptions. So it's either that or it's the hoops. There's no middle ground with this one, and that's what I like about it.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use. You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelday providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelday can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelday today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
I mean, it's ironic you mentioned Belgium, because I know the guy that took that picture did an interview a few weeks ago and said the hoax story is not true. I was forced to say that. I'll have to dig the article out. He gave an interview in the Belgian press a few weeks ago and basically said, yeah, I got pressured by certain individuals and they paid me a large amount of money to say I'd hoax a photo, but I can tell you now it's not true. It's a real picture.
Yeah. Well, Alex Birch did the same thing, didn't he?
Yeah.
He said he came out, said it was a hoax in the 1970s because he said that he was getting bullied. He was ruining his family life. So he spoke to the Daily Express and said it was painted on glass. And then in the late 1990s, when the X-Files and UFOs were back on the agenda, suddenly it was a genuine story again. Who knows? To me, it's just a good story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's fascinating.
So where will it go next? I mean, it's now being proclaimed by James Fox as being the best ever UFO story. And again, I think it is, because I know we've got this grainy footage from the US Navy pilots that's all over the place, but I actually think the Condyne, although it's a still and it's pre-digital camera, that's what's interesting about it. You haven't got all that metadata that you would have if you'd taken that on a digital camera. So it remains mysterious. But I think in terms of clarity, and when you first see it, and you've got to see the print in person, it looks much more impressive than the reproductions that you've seen online. I just think it's far better than anything they've got in America. And I find the fact that, although they've shown it, it keeps turning up in the latest thing that I can't remember what it's called that was doing the rounds on Twitter a few months ago, the latest disclosure film with all the talking heads. They flashed it up there. But no one appears to be willing to ask any questions about it in America. All these internet jockeys and Elizondo and all these other people, why has no one asked the Pentagon, what have you got on this photograph, or put in a Freedom of Information Act request about it? Because we know from our contacts here, it went to the Pentagon. They did analysis on it. They, you know, so there must be a whole trail of paperwork. And the guy that used to run Arrow, can't remember his name now, Fitzpatrick, he spoke to Danny Revelle when Danny Revelle did this article about it. And he came out with this ludicrous thing about, oh, yeah, it's obviously a rock sticking out of a pond or something, based upon what he read on the internet, not based upon any attempt to even look in his own records. This is the guy that says, I've got access to all the top secret stuff in the Pentagon. I can look at anything I want. There's nothing out of my reach. And yet, when he's asked about this crucial photograph, where does he go? Google. I mean, it's ludicrous, isn't it?
Well, it's baffling, especially coming from somebody like that, because you would suggest, especially in the modern climate, that these kind of excuses that they used to give, you know, during Project Blue Book and the infamous explanations of swamp gas and Venus and all that. It's like, oh, well, I read a talking head on YouTube who says it's a pond and therefore I believe him. Seriously? Are you honestly telling me that that's your critical analysis of this situation? That is even stupider than anything else I've seen recently.
Yeah, so that's where we are with it. And I just think it's fabulous because it just keeps on growing like a snowball rolling down a hillside.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I was very impressed because I really do like, as you mentioned, James Fox's body of work. I think he's a very good filmmaker. And like you say, he's a boots on the ground kind of guy. He's not the kind of does everything from an office somewhere in California. He likes to go wherever he can. I know he's done a lot of work in Brazil. He's been over to South Africa. I think he's been down to Australia, chasing down leads on Westall. So, and I've spoke to James a few times. He seems a very nice chap.
Yeah.
So fair play to him. And like you say, with the anniversary coming up this summer, who knows what's round the corner?
Well, I just like it that it's good for, in this world where everybody's polarized in their views, to be able to have a friendship and a genuine interactive discussion with someone who I fundamentally disagree with in terms of the what he's pushing. He's using all these interviews to push a certain view of what's going on, which I completely fundamentally disagree with, but I understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And I think surely we should be able to talk to people who we disagree with. I mean, this goes on in politics, in the culture wars and everything.
Yeah.
And get along without name calling and all the rest of it.
Well, absolutely. I think it is, you know, and obviously we've got very different standpoints in regards to this, but we always have cordial conversations because we appreciate each other's point of view.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, well, speaking of, I suppose you could suggest that Calvin is probably modern folklore.
Most certainly is. The people, this is what I get when I've had this online numerous times. It's like, you're saying this is nonsense because you're saying it's folklore. And I just say, no, you don't understand what folklore means. Go to a dictionary and look it up.
Well,
this
exactly.
idea that it's just folklore. What do you mean by just? You know, folklore is the beliefs, the traditions, the things that we, the stories that we call upon to understand things we don't understand, that we've had since we first crawled out of a cave and looked up at the stars. How can that just be just folklore?
Yeah.
You know, what I don't like is that people like to have everything in black and white. It's either true or it's untrue. It's false or it's true. And Danny Robbins is a perfect example of this. He's got his believer, skeptic, team skeptic or team believer. There's no room for any grey, no room for any, well, maybe, yeah, I think they believe what they're saying, but I don't necessarily believe that mermaids exist, but that people believe in mermaids for very good reasons. You know, that kind of nuance is just, there's no place for it in that kind of discourse. And that's why I like folklore, because you don't have to, it's not all about deciding whether something's true or false, because what might be true to one person is completely false to another, and vice versa. It's what you believe and what it means to you.
Absolutely. And I think this is the incredible thing, because I think a lot of us have kind of gone through some kind of transformative relationship with what folklore is. I know 10 years ago I was quite snotty about it, David. I thought it was old-fashioned, nonsensical stories about this, that, and the other. Reading a lot more, meeting other people, speaking with people, diving into this, doing this show, has completely turned me around 180 degrees. I am fully embracing it. I love it all now. I find the subjects we talk about, I understand how that fits in the pantheon of folklore, because it is. We're talking about experiences, about belief systems. We're talking about a fundamental change in the way people see the things around them that we often can't explain. And for someone like you, as you say, when you started as a journalist, you've covered two or three very notable local stories here. We've got the crying boy pictures. I can't see one without thinking of you these days, David. And I was in...
I'm not crying yet, though.
Not yet. The day is yet early. And I had to laugh. I visited the new Red Brick Collective Market near Bramall Lane the other week, and there was the Green Lady.
Who was that?
Picture in there for sale.
I've got that in my room, yeah. I can't pronounce the Russian artist's name, but you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember when... you did the folklore conference about 5 or 6 years ago, and you fetched a collection in. And even with the learned people there and the fact that we had got the whole evidence as to why these pictures didn't burn and whatever, I still found it really amusing to see people go out of their way to essentially push themselves flat against the wall to get past the pictures, David, even though we know why they didn't burn. It was what they were painted on.
Well, I remember the very last 14 Times Unconvention back in 2011. Andy Roberts and myself did a talk on cursed stone heads, you know, these like the Hexham heads. And we'd actually bought one of these things at an auction, this head that had been dug out of this at the grounds of a hall in West Yorkshire. And it made all the newspaper headlines at the time, and it was put up for auction. It was supposed to have laid a curse on this family who'd found it, and we bought it for £200 at an auction in... It's at the Folklore Centre in Todmorden now.
Yes.
It's been donated there. But we took it to London, and we had it on display after the after the talk, and we basically dared people to touch it because, you know, they'd be cursed if they did. And these learned folklorists and my wife, some of the people that were there, just like you said, Paul, they would not go near it. No one wanted to, well, some of them did, but others just didn't want to touch it. So the idea that people don't believe in these, you know, these long gone superstitions, and these are all things in the past. Never. They're here now. You know, I mean, on this survey that we've just completed, that's going to Ipsos UK as we speak, there's a load of questions about things like, you know, if you're walking down a street, you see a ladder, do you walk underneath it or do you go around it?
You go around it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so it's all old stuff that no one believes in anymore. But we all, I mean, in the 19th century, the learned folklorists, the people who published the learned journals on the subject, they were talking as if this stuff was only things that people in the countryside, ignorant peasants, believed in. You know, we educated Cambridge scholars, of course we don't have any folklore. You know, and yet they were all involved in their own little traditions and customs in the colleges. You know, M.R. James telling ghost stories at Christmas and all sorts of stuff. So everyone has folklore, and that certainly piques.
It is remarkable how some people view little things that they do as not being folklore. As you say, like going around a ladder. Touch wood is another one. Touch wood.
I mean,
what? You don't think that's throwing salt over your shoulder?
That one, that's in there. Are you from Sheffield originally?
Well, I'm from Barnsley, so I'm South Yorkshire. Yeah.
Well, in your family then, if you were ever given a knife as a gift, maybe you got married and somebody gives you a set of kitchen knives, was it a tradition that you couldn't accept the knives unless you gave some money in return, because otherwise it was potentially breaking a friendship that they were giving you a knife?
Yes. There was no sort of real denomination you had to give, but it was just the sort of transaction of, if you were receiving these, you had to repay them in kind.
Definitely, yeah. If you see a magpie, do you salute?
Yeah, morning, Captain.
Why?
I don't do it anymore. I used to do it. I don't do it anywhere near as much as I used to growing up. I think that's one of those traditions that gets sort of put into your DNA without you realising it. Coal on a New Year's Eve is another one.
Absolutely. Yeah. So all of this stuff, you know, is what we're interested in. And so the survey's got this is the National Folklore Service, I should explain, we got this Arts and Humanities Research grant to run, which is what I've been working on with Diane Rogers and Sophie Parks Neill for the last 6 months. So we designed it. It's got six sections. So there's stuff in there on supernatural beliefs and traditions. There's stuff on all the stuff we've been talking about, Paul, you know, the sort of what you would call personal traditions, lucky objects, you know, things you carry around, stuff about food, specific folklore associated with food. And so the survey is going to be run on 2,000 people, a representative sample of English residents. So in the run, in later this year, before Halloween, we'll be releasing the results. And I have no idea what they're going to be, but I think it's going to be some pretty exciting stuff.
Why do you think folklore's having this massive revival, David? Because it seems to be everywhere these days. Mm. And I know you can kind of say that, I think social media's helped, especially with the growth of modern paganism and modern Wicca. Yeah. I think that's certainly been a driving force behind that, because it's connected a lot of people who felt isolated or didn't really feel like they fitted into their society or wherever they lived. Yeah. And the internet has allowed them to connect to people all around the world who share the same kind of belief systems. And obviously, there are so many different strands inside paganism and Wicca. But you only have to look at once again, how it's appearing on popular culture. Both the BBC and Channel 4 here have done series in the last 2 years about folklore, one with Jonathan Ross, one with Charlie Cooper, comedian, writer. Yeah. Whose sister Daisy May Cooper is probably more famous at the moment, but obviously they're both been driving forces. So
there's all the performance artists, there's the Boss Morris, and the great thing about it is young people are embracing it and getting involved. You know, dressing up in costumes, going to events on May Day and Midsummer, all those kinds of things that were once associated, you know, with old people, you know, in rural, you know, cheese rolling and Morris dancing and stuff. Young people are embracing it. And the answer is, why is there this revival. I mean, it's like with ufology. It goes through sort of,
yes,
you know, crests and waves and stuff. I mean, the last big revival was the 1960s, which coincidentally was when the last survey of English folklore was done by John Whitson at the University of Sheffield, where he did it very differently to how we're doing it. It wasn't a representative survey, you know, a question survey. It was one where he just went out and handed out blank slips to people and said, write down your folklore on, under these categories. So that's more like, in academic language, it's qualitative rather than quantitative. So we're dealing with figures, numbers of people. So that was the last big revival, but that coincided with also the big occult revival. You know, yes, people, you know, the hippies and mysticism, taking LSD, all the psychedelic music from the late 1960s. And that's when you get all these paranormal programs and newspapers running stories about UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster. We're going through that again, and I think the reason for that is different to the 1960s. I think now we've got the influences are like the climate emergency, mm-hmm. and I think that's why a lot of young people are getting involved in folklore, because it's the one thing where that connects them to the natural world,
yeah.
and the traditions and beliefs of our ancestors, effectively, who did look after the world, who did value natural resources. I mean, look at the outcry about the Sycamore Gap
yes.
tree being chopped down. I mean, that guy who was convicted, one of them, said, I couldn't understand it. It was almost as if I'd murdered someone. You know, the reaction online. Well, yes, he did. A lot of people were absolutely shocked and offended, because chopping a mature tree down like that, an iconic tree, is almost like losing a member of your family. You know, and that shows that how the natural world now is so important for people. That's why people complain for clean rivers and water. It's why people, you know, aren't happy with like nuclear energy, et cetera, et cetera. So that appeals to that group of people, the same people you were talking about, you know, who go to Stonehenge at midsummer and all the rest of it. So it's got a new audience. And I think some of the older folkies, the people who were into this in the 1960s, are struggling to understand. They don't like it because they feel that their view of folklore is being appropriated by young people. You know, they're taking it away. They're using it in a way that it shouldn't be used. I just think folklore has always been evolving. It's never been static. So this idea that folklore is something that happened in the past by people other than us, you know, is nonsense. Folklore has been constantly evolving. I mean, just look at figures like Spring Eel Jack, for instance. That was a Victorian bogeyman. We've talked about Spring Eel Jack. But you could also trace stories about similar figures, leaping figures, back into, you know, the Middle Ages. And there's also stories about supernatural bogeyman today, like Slenderman, for instance, and Mothman. So it's a continuum. It's not something that's rooted in the past. It does have roots in the past, but it's not rooted there, and it's constantly changing.
Well, I think that's the thing about folklore, and I'm always quite surprised when I see previous generations try and gatekeep it, because the thing about folklore is it changes for the generation that find it. Everybody does. Yeah. And obviously, how people viewed things back in the 1960s is almost alien to people in 2025, David. It's like another world, never mind three generations ago for some people. And so you notice these things. I know, as you mentioned earlier, you look at the Folklore Centre at Todmorden, and Todmorden itself is obviously very famous for what happened with Alan Godfrey and the mysterious murder, death or whatever of Adamski. Which some people try to mash together, but I think they're just incidents that involve the same person. I don't think they're really connected personally, though some people are absolutely adamant that they are. But Todmorden has a history of strange things around it, and it's embraced its sort of modern reinterpretation of itself as an old Yorkshire market town into now it seems to be a hotbed of alternative culture. It's got a big folklore centre. You've got a wonderful regular lineup of speakers there. Several of our friends have been and given speeches there. You've got this great art scene there. You've got music. You've got a UFO group that meets regularly, which you would expect, to be fair, in that particular location. But you see them popping up all over the place. I mean, when I went to Edinburgh a couple of years ago, I popped into the Museum of Witchcraft there. That, from when I went 2 years ago to where it is now, seems to have doubled in size, because people are just almost going on pilgrimages to these places. And we're very lucky where we live, David. We've got incredible sites of old beliefs and practices on our doorsteps, dotted all over the Peak District.
Peak District's amazing, isn't it? It's just, yeah. It's got everything in terms of buildings, in terms of customs and traditions, ghost stories. You're literally falling over them wherever you go. And people are getting more and more into this, and not just in an exploitative way as well. What we find, what I'm finding more is, it's like this idea that they've even tested this, haven't they? That people are having mental health problems, going out into nature, sitting in a forest, you know, watching the sun come up, is far better than any tablet you can be prescribed by your GP, you know. And so we've actually literally had people coming in and saying, you know, folklore has saved me, you know, getting out into the countryside, immersing myself in all this is the thing that's turned my life around. And so it's all about resilience as well, you know, and about coping with all the pressures that everyone is under in this crazy mad world that we live in. Folklore is almost like sanctuary. It's something that, although it's changing, it's also unchanging as well, because it moves backwards into the past and looks forward into the future. I can't think of another subject that is that immersive and that positive. I mean, it's not entirely free from the dark side, but, you know, I think it's largely a very good thing, and it's something that if you could prescribe it and get your GP to prescribe it for you, it would do you a world of good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, like you say, I mean, it's amazing because we've got these sites all over the place where we live, but also it's in some of the most beautiful scenery in the United Kingdom. And these places are very busy in summer, especially. I noticed primarily during the pandemic how many people really re-embraced nature when we were sort of let back out of the house, David, that first one. I remember we went for a walk round Lady Bower, and we gave up after half an hour. We couldn't find anywhere to park.
Oh, yeah.
It was like Sheffield had just gone to Lady Bower the same day.
I mean, pre-COVID, you could go to Fairholmes, which is the big National Trust, not National Trust, but it's the big car park, Severn Trent.
Yes.
At the big reservoir complex just between Sheffield and Manchester. And I mean, I used to go out there all the time, constantly. Now, on weekends, forget it. You can't get anywhere near it. It's like Glastonbury Festival. You need to go on foot, really.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, whilst we can feel a bit disappointed in its popularity now, that's a great thing to see.
It is, but there's also problems it's creating. You know, the Instagrammers and the TikTokers who are going to, I mean, like Mantor, for instance, has become the place to go to see sunrise because people have posted this on Instagram and all the rest of it. And now you go up there now and the roads are double parked, jammed, police are having to tow cars away.
Yes.
And there's got to be a limit to this, but it seems that we've exceeded that limit. So places can be damaged. And I know I put quite a lot on Facebook, which you've probably seen. You know, I've been out on the weekend and I've visited this place and that place. Just this last 2 years, some of the places I've been to, I've actually taken, before pressing send, I thought, do I really want to tell people about this? You know, it's nice, it's quiet, it's somewhere I can go, or the people who know about it, who are serious about the subject, they know where it is. Do we really want crowds of people putting, oh, this is that amazing carving on a stone somewhere. Oh, look at it, I've been up there. And then you get thousands of other people coming. The next thing you know, it's been vandalised or stolen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great that people are getting out there, but a lot of these people have never been out in the outside towns and cities. They don't know how to treat the countryside with respect. And, you know, some of the stone circles, for instance, get an enormous amount of hammer. You know, people have spray painted stuff on Avery stones, they light fires, they bury crystals. And these people might think that they're following ancient traditions, but they're not, because you would not disrespect a 4,000-year-old sacred site by burying a crystal there. I'm sorry. I'm still upset that is a genuine tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is striking because it's something I've always really enjoyed, history and archaeology. And I've always found certain sites really powerful, David, when I've gone there, depending on when you go. And I remember a couple of years ago, we went to the Lake District and we were stopping near Castlerigg, which is obviously one of incredible stone circles that we've got here.
Yeah.
And we went up there on a Sunday morning in August, and it was almost as if you could put your hands up above your head and you could touch the sky. And it was one of those perfect moments where I could imagine somebody building that site on a day like that and thinking that they were close to heaven or whoever they wished to speak to for whatever reason in that particular area. It gave me a far better sense of my position in that area at that time. It felt special because of the way the environment had sort of played its part on top of the positioning of the stone circle. It was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and they are perfectly sited in the landscape, aren't they? I mean, and I was reading something the other day where someone had looked at the stones and how they perfectly mirror the mountains in the background.
Yes.
You know, and then you've got that amazing shadow path that appears at midwinter, which I've never seen. I'd love to see it, where one of the tall one of the stones casts like a big long shadow into the circle. And you can, if you were there and you weren't surrounded by Instagrammers, you might be able to sort of think that you go back and imagine that you were there 4,000 years ago. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I do think we've seen a spiritual shift here. I mean, the last census that was done found that to the number of people who were saying or putting down on the religion category that they were practicing Christians had dropped below 50% for the first time in the whole history of the census. Mm. And the people who were saying that the Wiccans, they're Odinists, they are New Age people, it's on the up, you know. So and I feel almost sad for Christianity, because I go to the amazing churches. I mean, I went to one on the weekend in Rotherham, amazing Anglo-Saxon church in Rotherham. And yeah, luckily we were there when there was a baptism going on, but it's quite clear that no one's going to the churches anymore. Mm. You know, the vicar is caring for like four or five churches in that parish, you know, and the people who go regularly to church, who aren't just going there to get married or baptized or for a funeral, are literally dying off. There's none left. Mm. You know, how do you get young people into churches? Where are they going? They're going to stone circles.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, it's straight. I've forgotten where I was. It might have been in the Lake District. I think I got talking to a vicar in a pub, ironically, and he was saying he looked after four or five in the parish because there simply wasn't the congregation to justify anybody else being there. And like you say, I love visiting those kinds of places. I'm not religious at all, but I appreciate the history. I appreciate the art. I appreciate the architecture of the building. I know when you were sharing those pictures of the gargoyles and the grotesques, I love stuff like that. And you even see it where I live here, that there's one particular church in Healy at the bottom here, which has a very notable grave. It's the guy that invented the rules of football. But if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know, because there's nothing to pull you to that place. The graveyard is incredibly overgrown, apart from the entrance to the church and a bit round the side, but there's weeds everywhere, and I love a graveyard, David. I just think they're fascinating, as you well know, we've got some brilliant ones around here. I mean, you only have to look at Eme for a great example of a wonderfully historic village for a variety of reasons, but their graveyard and the architecture of the church and the stained glass there is breathtaking.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I know the one at Healy you mentioned, because some of my relatives are buried there.
Right.
Yeah, my grandmother's family lived at Healy, so a lot of the Hibberts are in that graveyard.
I'll keep my eye out next time. But it is sad. But I suppose it's also surprising, like you say, I think there are numerous reasons for why a lot of young people are kind of reconnecting with nature. And you can see that even with the growth of sort of fringe beliefs like animism, that people are really sort of reconnecting to it. I mean, obviously we've got a couple of alternative kind of shops here in Sheffield, but and I've known them for a long time. Even I, knowing people that I know, have seen more and more people are going there for candles, crystals, tarot, spiritual guidance in a variety of fields, celebrating specific dates in the calendar, really sort of embracing that side of their sort of belief system now, which was the kind of thing I expected to happen after the late 80s and sort of rave culture kind of gave that kind of youth a rebirth where they were kind of reconnecting with people around them and trying to drop out of the society and how fast-paced the world was going at that time. And then it kind of pulled them back in again in the sort of 90s. Now, it seems that people have really drawn a line in the sand and gone, no, I'm going this way. I don't like the way the world's going.
Well, I mean, when I've been asked about this by journalists, you know, about what, how do I account for it? We've talked about the climate thing, but also I think it's an anti-technology pushback. I think it's this thing we've got ourselves into now. When we talk about COVID, I just think you just walk around. It's almost as if something's come down from the sky and taken over people's minds, with people wandering around looking at their phones and in their own little bubbles, and they're completely detached from everyone else except their little thing that they're involved in online. And it's doing people's heads in, literally. It's just so bad for mental health. It's not what human beings should be doing. Human beings want to relate to other people, and people are retreating into themselves, and it's not good, and it's creating, it's contributing to this mental health pandemic that we're in the middle of now. Whereas if you get involved in the sort of things we've been talking about, connecting with nature and doing things as a community, that's where human beings came from. It's what is natural to us. So I think also it's this idea that science, all the fantastic benefits that science have brought us, and I'm not trying to decry any of them, penicillin, you know, rockets to the moon and all the rest of it, but this idea that science explains everything, that, you know, and anything we don't understand, eventually we will understand. I think that is the most corrosive thing you can say to a human being. You know, it's taking all the enchantment out of the universe. What is wrong with fairy stories, telling kids that Father Christmas exists, believing that aliens are coming to visit us and looking after us, or angels, whatever one, you know, these are the things that give meaning to existence. You take all that out, like back to the Calvin thing, these ultra debunkers who, this thing that stands out from that story for me, the people who just cannot accept that that photograph could possibly be of a genuine unidentified flying object in the sky. No such thing exists. Neither do spy planes. Therefore, it's got to be a hoax. All we've got to do is just prove it's a hoax. That's an example of how the enchantment has been taken out of everything. And then you get the people pushing back and won't believe. And although I don't think you should just believe blindly in anything, that gets us into some serious problems, you know, where you can justify exterminating people, et cetera, on the basis of something that's written in a book, thousands of years ago. But enchantment is important. It's important to all of us. And when you take that out, people will push back. Enchantment will find its way back into our existence the more you try and eradicate it. So that, to me, explains why we're going through this folklore revival. I just hope it lasts however long it needs to last.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been really surprised myself about how much has always gone on in many things have been going on here in Sheffield, for example, that I was completely unaware of until the last sort of 2 or 3 years. The sword dance over at Grenaside is a prime example of that. And I think you went, was it Boxing Day last year?
Yeah, well, I used to go to the one at Handsworth because that's where I was born and brought up, and they've got a sword dance there. Mm. And I was aware of the Grenaside one, but I didn't go because it was very, oh no, you're from Handsworth, so you go to the Handsworth sword dance. But I've since moved I moved to Crooks and Walkley, which was near Grenaside. So I started going there because it was simply easier to get there on Boxing Day. And I got to know all the Grenaside team. And it's very different to the Handsworth dance. And they've got that ritual beheading thing that they do as part of it, which is really distinctive. And, you know, it sort of builds up to this crescendo. I just love it. I just love going to see them. And they came along and did a performance at the Urban Legends Conference that we had here at the Sheffield Hallam back in 2023, and they just went down a storm. You know, people absolutely loved it.
Mm. Well, I think they're the kind of things that, once again, the rise of the internet has allowed people to see something that, unless you were in that specific area, David, and the same probably for Handsworth. You know, I've lived in Sheffield 32 years. I was not aware of either of those things happening until about 3 or 4 years ago, primarily because people I knew had gone and taken pictures or videoed it. Other than I would never have known.
The pub Carol Singing, that's huge. It started in the northwest, the Sheffield, didn't it? You know, Stannington and that area. But now it's everywhere. It's all through the Peak District. And again, it's people coming together, doing something spontaneously that doesn't involve mobile phones and emails and all the rest of it that's driving us crazy. You know, people are actually doing something spontaneously as human beings and enjoying themselves.
I mean, there was loads. I was researching something about Mary Clyde, which is obviously the wonderful horse head skeleton that goes around bothering people at Christmas in Wales. But whilst I was reading about it, I then discovered that we had a version round here.
Yes.
In Norton, and that particular era that kind of died out in the 50s and 60s. I think the last time somebody sort of reported it going on was sort of 67, 68.
All right.
But they still have it going on. I think it's called the Derby Tup. In certain parts of Derbyshire, it still happens. And I looked at that and I felt really sad because Mary Clwyd is one of those wonderfully British eccentric pastimes that goes on that you would really be hard pressed. But clearly, it wasn't Mary Clwyd is the one that survived. There seem to have been pockets all over the United Kingdom doing something similar. Yeah.
Very big in Kent as well. The Hudney Horse, I think it's called there. But we had, like you said, Paul, in Sheffield and northeast Derbyshire, it was the Old Horse, I think it was called.
Mm.
So it was a genuine horse skull that had been retrieved from a knacker's yard or something. And they used to put it on a pole and have like somebody dressed in a costume. And again, it was like one of these Christmas stroke New Year customs where people would go from house to house. Knocking on doors, gathering coins and doing like a mini George and the Dragon play. All sorts of interesting things. But again, it's died out.
Mm. Are you surprised when we touched on a few examples earlier in regards to how immersed folklore still is in a lot of people's daily lives? But as you say, they might dismiss it as a superstition, but people still do certain things and they don't believe that that's a folkloric tradition or custom, but it clearly is, isn't it?
It is. Because, I mean, again, we mentioned John Widdowson, and he's got this story that he tells, like when he was a student in the 1960s, I think it was, and he did his master's thesis on the dialect of Filey, and there was no folklore centre in England, so he had to go to Canada to study folklore at Memorial University in St. John's in Newfoundland, that still is the big place where if you're interested in folklore, that's where you go and do your PhD. So he did his PhD there under Herbert Halpert, Canadian folklorist. And in his first session, I mean, John at that time knew very little about folklore. And his attitude was, well, I don't have any traditions. And so Herbert Halpert gave him this set of a list of the folklore genres. Things you did as a child, hopscotch, et cetera, you know, things passed down through the family, all the things like what we've been talking about, traditions, beliefs, customs, superstitions. And John filled this in and he was at it for hours and massive big list, gave it back to his tutor and he said, and you say you've got no folklore? it's a cracking anecdote, but like with the survey we're doing now, I've given it to people who told me, oh, I don't know anything about this. No, folklore is something I don't know about. They come back after filling it in. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot all about that. My grandmother told me X, Y, Z. Love doing it. Really a lot of fun filling it in. You know, so everyone has folklore. And the interesting thing here is, you know, the big skeptics conference that they have in Manchester every year, QED.
Yes.
I was invited to speak at that on the Calvin incident, funnily enough. So I did this talk on Calvin, but they also dragged me into a panel discussion about all kinds of folkloric things and Charles Fort, et cetera, et cetera. And I made the point there that you, the audience, as skeptics, although you see yourselves as scientific materialists and all of this stuff can be explained, you've got folklore because this conference is folklore in that you are all skeptics, i.e. part of a group, a folk group, who disbelieve. And you have your own traditions in that you come to Manchester every September to have your conference, and you do things. You stay in a hotel. You have certain things that you do on the Saturday night and on the Sunday morning. That's folklore. And he was like, what is it? Oh, my God.
Well, I think that's one of the things about you, David, is that people would, some people who don't know you and don't know your body of work in full, would consider you sceptical. Whereas I think, but you're the sceptic in the true sense of the word, because you've still got this joy for confusion and strangeness and the magic in the world, as we've said about why folklore is so important still. Whereas some people, as you say, if science can't explain it, it can't possibly be real. And there is an explanation for everything. And you will see this, like you were saying earlier about team skeptic, team believer, that often putting forward an explanation that has a basis in reality is fine, but often they don't fit the parameters of what they're trying to explain away. And sometimes you can get very frustrated. I mean, I've heard skeptics claim that bears can pick up rocks and throw them like people can, which has never been recorded. They've been seen to jewel them like otters do, but they can't pick up a rock and throw it at somebody, as one particular hairy humanoid witness was claiming that they were sort of assaulted in a cabin by these creatures throwing rocks at them, who was a bear conservationist. He knew what a bear was and what it did. It was his career. And yet he was told he didn't understand what bears could do.
A perfect example of this, talking about Danny Robbins, you will have watched all the recent TV series. The guy that they've got on, Kieran, I think it is, who's the skeptic. I just think, are you taking the mickey or what? He just sits there. And what was it? The thing about the people in the house that who'd everything had been moving. So they set up like a
pole. The wind tunnel.
So they set up this wind. So his theory was, oh, yes, it could have been some kind of, what was it, an underground landslip that had created this rush of air. And then Danny Robbins then obviously had to get like a wind tunnel set up. And I just thought, I mean, are you seriously suggesting that explains what? I mean, it just makes skepticism look ludicrous, and far more ludicrous than believing there was a genuine spirit in the house. I mean, again, you've got to see this in the context. It's entertainment. Mm. You know, seeing that picture of Danny Robbins with his face contorted, you know, sort of holding onto the table, it's pure entertainment. So
yes.
Trying to break it down logically, and I just think it's becoming almost. I mean, I don't want to offend people who are fans of that show, and I know there are legions of them, but I just think it's become a caricature of itself. I just think, what's it for? It's not genuine paranormal investigation. We're almost in the what was it called? The thing, the most haunted territory. That's the way it's going.
Yeah, I think they've got a fair way down to get to that level.
Yeah, it's more horrible now. I just think it's becoming a joke. That's my view.
But I think I think it's still remarkable that the BBC seem to have really embraced it massively, which kind of came from nowhere. Because obviously, I interviewed Danny about 4 years ago when he'd obviously had his big launch with the Battersea Poltergeist, and that's clearly the sort of starting point for Uncanny success built off the back.
I mean, I've got to say, I thought that was excellent. I love the podcast the most, a lot. I mean, I was interviewed on the podcast series.
Yes, you were. Yeah,
so it is me criticising the only thing I was on. But, the Battersea Poltergeist thing was done very, very well. But the trouble is, you do something successfully, and then the people who are paying your wages and are commissioning more series, they just want more of the same. So they just keep quarrying it until the mineral's gone, you know, rather than sort of, I don't know how best to put this, but I think it started out well. I'm not sure it's transferred to television all that well, I suppose is what I'm getting at.
Well, sometimes it is interesting, and as someone who's the majority of information and entertainment I consume these days is podcast-based rather than televisual. It is strange how sometimes podcasts just don't transfer. Whether it's because of the pictures you can paint through just speaking about subjects rather than having all the whistles and bangs and all the palaver of a televisual production, maybe sometimes overshadows everything. And like you say, it has to be bigger and better because it's television. Whereas The spoken word is often the simplest way of getting a message across.
Absolutely agree. So we'll see. Will the folklore revival continue? I hope so.
Mm. I mean, before I let you leave, David, what's the one thing that you've discovered through this journey over the last 5 years that you've surprised yourself about, or you've really embraced and sort of immersed yourself in a particular tranche of folklore that you wouldn't have considered when you remember those heady days of dealing with terrified families fleeing from haunted pictures?
I think what I've arrived at is that, to use a Yorkshire phrase, there's not as strange as folk. I think the real mystery is human beings, who we are, where we are, where did we come from, and the weird things that we experience and believe in. Mm. That's what I pick out of all this.
I mean, even for us living here in Sheffield, it is noticeable how you've got different parts of Sheffield that have very different beliefs about a similar sort of central totem often.
Yeah, I mean, it is very regional, isn't it, folklore? But then there are themes like Phantom Hitchhikers, for instance. You get a really strong story somewhere like Bluebell Hill in Kent.
Yep.
But the people who know about that story and who tell it aren't necessarily aware of the fact that there's a similar story in Athersage, in Derbyshire, yep, or wherever, you know. But and then you've got to ask, how do they all relate to each other? Is it one story that's been told that then people around in different localities have picked up on? Or how else do you explain it? Is it the collective consciousness or unconsciousness?
Yeah. Are we just creating tulpas and they're just wandering around doing their own thing these days? We've got loads of just unsupervised tulpas hiding, lurking on lonely roads to terrify motorists.
All I know is there's enough for 2, 3, 4 lifetimes of research and study. And, you know, I'm trying to make the most of this lifetime.
So, David, where can everybody learn more about the folklore projects that you're working on with your colleagues at Hallam University in the Centre of Contemporary Legend, as well as keeping up to date with your writings through your personal Substack page?
Well, our new website now for this folklore survey, if you just simply Google National Folklore Survey, you will find our new All Singing, All Dancing website, and you can contact us through that. And later this year, after we've got the results from Ipsos of the national survey, so we'll be putting out all those results based upon the 6 categories, the 55 questions that we've asked this sample of people. Once we've got those results and put them out, then we will be putting the survey on our website, and you'll be able to use a QR code and fill it out yourself. And so next year, we're sort of taking it out on the road. So we'll be traveling around the country, doing little road shows at museums and art galleries, that kind of thing, and collecting more rich data, you know, so the stuff that we couldn't ask people about, the open questions, and some of the things that have been brought up in the survey, you know, that need to be explored further, will then be asking people in more depth.
So fabulous.
The more the merrier. Contact us.
Brilliant. Absolutely. I shall put links to that and your personal scrabblings that you upload often, discussing a variety of strange phenomena over the years, and so people can follow that. And I just want to say thanks so much for joining me again. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. Let's not leave it 4 years.
No, and, no.
Hopefully I'll see you sooner rather than later, my friend.
Yeah. Like maybe later this year when we get the results, that might be a good time to meet up again. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Always a pleasure.
Oh, you're a very kind man. And I was going to say, ironically, I know you mentioned the Hexham Heads before I let you leave. That was the very first time we met when you presented Richard McLean Smith's talk during the Off the Shelf Festival.
Do you remember that? Yeah. And to go back to the Folklore Centre at Todmorden, I believe they've got an exhibition on or imminent on the Hexham Heads with some of the replicas that were made of the, I mean, the originals have long since disappeared. That's another whole story that we could explore at some point. But the genuine replicas that were made by the man who claimed to have made the original heads have been donated to the Folklore Centre. So they're going to be on exhibition there in Todmorden alongside the cursed head that I bought at auction back in 19, whenever it was. So go to Todmorden, which is a fantastic place, and visit Holly Elsden's amazing Folklore Centre, everyone.
Certainly will. David, thank you as always, my friend. Take care.
All right. Cheers. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.